This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show Series 5, Episode 8. What have you heard? Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we talk about the language of coaching and why some people roll their eyes when they hear management speak, but it's not always the case. We also talk about bat weight, and we get a tip from Ian Ponce, Ultimate Pace Secrets, about braced front legs. All that and more coming up on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to another edition of the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, your guide to playing or coaching, or playing and coaching better cricket, depending on where you are in your cricketing career. My name is David Hinchliffe, and I'm joined, as always, by Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School, although he's not there today, Mark Garraway. Garraz, where are you?
I'm at Loughborough. I'm sitting in the National Cricket Performance Centre. I'm watching a man roll a square outside, which is good to see him out there. And out in front of me in the hall are Matthew Maynard, Tony Middleton and Mark Ramprakash doing a session on playing spin for the candidates that are up here doing their level 4 batting module.
Well, there's some ECB coaching superstars there. I think we're going to talk about that a little bit more. And also joining me on the line, of course, the Mark Garraway of Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Welcome to the show, Lavis.
Morning, how are we?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. And what are you up to today?
Oh, I'm not in quite as glamorous surroundings and as Garraz is. However, I'm sure Tone's delighted to be called a cricket coaching superstar. So he'll be happy with that, alongside Ramps and the others.
Well, exactly. Well, you know, you have to look at everybody who contributes something. So, Garraz, I wanted to think a little bit about the language of cricket coaching this week, because it's changed a lot in recent years. And I think where you are at the moment is, you know, probably an example of exactly how the language of cricket coaching has changed. Borrows a lot more from management speak these days, and it's that is often criticised. You know, when someone says hit the right areas instead of bowl line and length, people roll their eyes. So what do you think about how the language of coaching cricket has changed in the last 10, 15 years?
Well, it has, and I think you've hit the nail on the head that there is a lot of management speak around, but I think one of the things that sits behind it is a lot of education and a lot of transferable skills and demonstrations which have come from the business world and actually positively impacted upon the way that coaches manage themselves and manage others around them. And Sam's been through the level 4 process. I'm presently presenting on the level 4 in the module for batting and leading that up. And the previous few modules have been around advanced coaching skills, and a lot of that work has been taken not just from a sporting world, from a business world as well. And somebody who's just been in the room working in a Q&A capacity has been Dr. Steve Bull, who's somebody who's worked in 28 years in high performance sport, but also worked with some of the biggest brands across marketing, some of the biggest brands in terms of selling things, companies like Coca-Cola and Disney. And he's brought his experience from both worlds and molded it into something that can work for cricket coaches. Now, the challenge for any cricket coach is then, when we are publicly speaking, is to make things sound real, because when we're talking to the public through journalists, for example, we need to make things sound absolutely real, and that the punter who sits in the stands and watches a game and turns on Sky Sports can relate to. And I think sometimes we've got that wrong in the past in presenting our management stuff that we do with the players actually to the wider world. And obviously the players have got some experience of being in those environments, whereas the wider world haven't. And you've got to be very careful about, you know, your press conferences and your interviews as a result of that.
Lavis, how much have you integrated new ways of saying things into the way that you coach, and how much have you stuck to the more traditional ways of saying things?
Well, I think when delivering to a group, it's very dependent on the group you're delivering to and their knowledge, as Garraz suggests there, of the type of language you're going to use. So as Garraz referred to there, when you're talking to the media, you've got to try and alter your delivery to that that you might use to a group of players who know exactly what you're referring to all the time. I think it's the same with junior coaching or club coaching in comparison to professional cricket. I think a lot of the slang or the different types of terminology that get picked up from professional cricket gets transferred and then gets utilised without really knowing what it actually means. And I try and keep things as simple as possible when it comes to talking to people and try to be very specific in what I say. And if I'm asking someone to hit an area, as you suggested earlier on, I'd sooner with a lesser experienced cricketer, I'd rather than saying let's hit our areas, I'd try and be clear in identifying or asking them to identify the areas that we're looking to hit. Or if we're similarly for a batter, if we're looking to work to a specific plan, there may be various plans with more advanced cricketers that are pre-discussed, pre-planned and already organised, but with lesser experienced cricketers they're not. So we've got to make sure that we're simpler, keep things simpler to lesser experienced cricketers or cricketers who are lesser experienced in that environment. And similarly, as Mark had said, with the general public, for those people who are dealing with media as well, that when dealing with the media, we've got to make sure that they are referred to and terminology used suits them and suits their knowledge base, rather than just taking the jargon that we use every day with professional players.
And it's the same with parents, isn't it? You know, because not everybody deals with the media. Right? We obviously realise that. But we deal with external partners on a regular basis who aren't necessarily totally au fait with the environments in which you work. So, you know, if either of us, Sam, were to talk to a parent and use the same language as we do in our coaching sessions with players that we've worked with for 4 or 5 years, then they would be lost. So, again, you have to convert that into language which is for the recipient's benefit rather than the giver's benefit.
I think when you're looking at any term, whether it's a new term or an old term, is the key to it is to ask yourself, is the person or people that you're saying those words to, is that the clearest way that you can say it? So, and do they understand it in the way that you want them to understand it? So line and length versus areas is a slightly deceptive one in that pretty much everybody understands both of those terms now, and you can interchange them quite easily, and it doesn't make a lot of difference. I don't think anybody would complain too much if you said try and hit an area rather than saying try and hit line and length. Are there any terms where you really do think to yourself, well, that's just not a useful term? It's sprung up, but it's not really very useful for anybody in any situation, or does it always depend?
I'm actually not a massive fan of using line and length or areas as a generic term, just because the conditions we play in are so differing day to day that the line and length and the areas change dramatically. So I try and steer clear of those terms and just specifically say fuller or shorter or eight yards or 10 yards or 6 yards or whatever we want to do for our measurements, so which our bowlers, especially our fast bowlers, can relate to pretty well. They know when they're hitting a 4 yard or a 6 yard, yeah, or an 8 yard length generally. So I'd try and be more specific than that, just purely because of the big range in conditions that we play in, especially with the first team at school, where we'll play on some pitches which are probably as good as first class pitches and others, given the sort of time of year, that are absolutely nowhere near. So I'd actually try and be more specific than using those terms.
And that's where a review, a really good review of yourself as a coach comes in, when you can turn around and say, did those people understand what I was trying to deliver there? Did I use the language that engaged them, or did I use language which just, as we said, bamboozled them? And as a player, I guess if you're looking at it from a player's point of view, you can ask yourself, is the language that the coach is using different from the way that I engage with? How can I translate that into something else myself? And it can become a two-way street as well, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I think is a really good tip for checking that review process is actually to ask the person that you're working with, what have you heard? And rather than what have I just said, where they're likely to regurgitate your words, they'll then interpret it in their own way. So they'll feedback in their own words back to you, and then you can assess whether the message has got lost through some blurred lines of communication or some jargon or whatever the case may be. So it's a question I regularly ask people, if what have you just heard?
Okay, that's a bit of gold there. So let's leave it there and let's head into the yes-no round. That is three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more we want to say. And I've plucked them from this week's headlines in most cases. So I'll be in charge of the questions, and you chaps can answer yes or no. First question, Graham Smith will be remembered as an all-time great.
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
Second question, the Asia Cup performance of Bangladesh shows they deserve full member status.
Yes.
No.
Third question, you are a better coach with technology.
Yes.
Yes.
It's about time we talked technique on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. It's an area that is always popular when we're talking about batting especially. And who better to talk technique than Pitch Vision Academy's very own batting coach, Gary Palmer. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Hi, Dave. Good to be back. We haven't spoken for a while.
Yeah, it's been a little while, but there's always an opportunity to talk about technical things. And this week, I wanted to get your opinion on the short ball. Playing the short ball, what kind of practice you need to do to face the short ball, and when to bring it into a program. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, obviously the short ball and playing quick bowling, whether you're playing club cricket in the second team and trying to get into the first team, or county second team to first team, or county cricket to test cricket, sometimes that can be the stumbling block to go get into that higher grade of cricket. But as far as practicing it, I think it would be counterproductive to just go in a net and put the bowling machine up to 75, 80 and bang it in short at someone before you've actually worked on their technique of playing the back foot defence or drive over and around the wicket. A young lad might come into a net, never played balls at that pace. Maybe his technique's not right. Maybe he's too sideways on, which is a key thing in all this. Because if he's too sideways on and someone fires a bowling machine in short his sort of throat or head or chest around that area, he's going to feel scared initially. Not because he's possibly scared, but because he's in such a bad position, he finds it hard to get at the ball. So therefore, unless he's had the coaching prior to going in that environment, he might back away and the coach might think, well, he's fine, he's not very good. Well, actually, if he'd have been trained to be more open through gradual building up of the process, he would have found it easier to play and have been less scared of being hit. So I think, first of all, you need to get your lads throw tennis balls at them, over and, more importantly, around the wicket, so you can show them that more open body position. Then you'd probably want to do underarm feeds up at their body from over and around the wicket, again, from sort of, I don't know, 10 yards away. Then you'd probably want to bounce the ball in over, then around the wicket. Then you'd probably get on the machine and bowl it, and build it up from maybe 55 miles an hour to 60 to 65, and make sure that you do all the over the wicket first. And then when you go around the wicket, get your speeds down again and gradually build the speeds up. So you're luring that player into being mentally or psychologically confident stage by stage of pushing it a bit further to play that short ball.
And that's all we've got time for from Gary this week, but you can hear the rest of the interview if you head over to pitchvision.com/Gary Palmer. Now, time for the mailbag. Couple of questions, and the best question that's sent in, of course, wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can send your questions in to coach@pitchvision.com, and we've got more contact details coming up at the end of the show. However, the two contenders this week, the first of the two contenders this week, is Shiv. And Shiv has got a question about bats. Shiv says, I've seen a lot of batsmen using a heavier bat. Does it really help to improve timing and stroke play? I'm currently using a lighter one. Will moving on to a heavier bat help me improve my batting? I'm confident with my stroke play at the moment. I think this is a timely question because bats at the top level are getting heavier, and batsmen are hitting the ball further than ever. So assuming that someone can cope with a heavier bat, should they be using one automatically?
Well, for me, I think you sort of hit the nail on the head right there. It was assuming someone can use the bat, and ultimately it comes down to the person and the individual and whether or not they can still manipulate the bat in the same way that they can manipulate the lighter bat. I think bats may or may not be getting heavier at the moment. I know they're getting bigger, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're getting a lot heavier. A lot of bats at professional level now are pressed less and they're dried better, which means they don't retain as much water, which ultimately means they don't last as long either. But they generally they look a lot bigger, but don't carry the same weight. So obviously a lot of people who see those bats on TV want to emulate them. And if you go in the shop and buy one, it means buying to buy a £2.07 bat that a pro uses, you've got to buy a £2.12 bat that sits on the shelf in the shop. So I can see why people want to do it, and people's desire to have what the pros have, which is understandable. Ultimately, though, you need to be able to manipulate the bat in the way that's going to best suit your game. And if you're sacrificing your ability to adjust or swing through a line of the ball or change the direction of your stroke play because of the extra weight that you're carrying on the bat, then maybe it's a sacrifice that you shouldn't be making. I think one of the key things he says is he's confident at the moment. So if he's confident and presumably happy with his cricket, then why change? Obviously, you don't have to stay the same all the time. But if he's confident with his stroke play, it might be one of those things where he can go and experiment, maybe try it out, but don't feel like you have to do something just because someone else is doing it because one of his friends is at the moment.
Yeah, you're right there, Levis, of course. Yeah, because bats, the great big heavy bats are a bit of a thing of the past, aren't they? I suppose I was thinking about the tiny little bats that were around many, many years ago.
Yes.
Gareth, what's your view on this one?
Well, I completely agree with everything that Labours has just said, really. I haven't got too much more to add in terms of value, but there was a really interesting Sky interview between Ian Ward, who facilitated it, NASA and Warney and Athers last year during a rain break, where they got a mixture of the bats that Athers used over the course of his career and then put some of the present England players' bats in a row, and they compared and contrasted. And obviously the shape of them, in particular the sort of thickness of the edges and then the thickness of a sweet spot had been were very much different going through the ages. But what they did work out was when they were picking them up, in terms of pickup, the new ones, some of the Indian bats, for example, that Sam talked about earlier, which aren't dried out which are dried out more and not pressed so much, actually picked up very similar to some of the matchsticks that Athers was using at the height of his test match career. So I'm with Sam completely on that. But it was a really nice piece of video just to demonstrate the evolution of bats and also to hear the comments of the people that were taking it in turns picking them up and talking about their own preferences as well. And that's really what it comes down to, doesn't it? It's preference, and it sounds like Shiv has found his preference. It's a fantastic question, I think, for debate, but he seems to have found his preference because his stroke play is confident at the moment. So you've answered, Shiv, but you've allowed us to elaborate on it, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I suppose really what we're saying is a heavy bat doesn't make a good bat. A heavier bat doesn't make a better bat. There's a lot of factors that go into making a good bat. A weight is one of the elements, but if you take that on its own, then it's not going to give you the complete answer. You need to look at a whole range of different things. And, of course, the top bats that the top internationals use are going to be the best bats in terms of the quality of the willow and the way that they're used, and they don't need to last very long, so they can compromise on longevity to make them be the ball be hit further, and they don't have to worry about it if it breaks because they can just grab another one whereas you're an average club player, you might be only able to afford one bat every 3 or 4 or 5 years. So, you know, you have to take those all those factors into account when you're looking at the type of bat that you're using. Okay, let's move on to the next question. This question says, I am Rush from India. Hello, Rush. And he says, I just read the book online, The Ultimate Pace Secrets. Of course, he's read that on Pitch Vision Academy. And that is by Ian Pont, a man who knows a thing or two about fast bowling. And he says, my problem is that my front leg collapses and bends. I'm not able to generate pace. So can you help me by giving me drills on how to keep my front leg straight so that I can generate more power from my legs and bowl fast? Classic question. How can I bowl fast? But very, very specific point. That's why I like this one. So, Gareth, what do you think?
Well, there will be a reason. There always is a root cause, and it's something that we talk a lot about in our coaching nowadays, which is fantastic. So, why is that front leg bending? You want to bowl over a more braced front leg. It sounds like you've got a good understanding of that as a result of reading The Ultimate Pace Secrets. But it's now, how are you going to convert what you're presently doing with your legs bending into being able to bowl over a braced front leg? So if we explore the reasons why that could happen, one of the reasons is that there's a misalignment between your back foot and your front foot. And often that misalignment is going towards the leg stump of a right-hander. So you'll see from behind, if you have a video camera, that the back foot will land and then the front foot will come and appear on the right-hand side of that foot. And often you'll find that people then are having to realign all of their forces to the target. And as a result of realigning those forces, the first thing that's going to bend to alleviate that pressure that's going in the wrong direction will be that front knee. So that's one of the first things. The other thing is that your bound height might be a little bit too much, so your down force is too significant for your body to be able to withstand and use the ground forces effectively. So if you're coming from too much of a height, and that often happens with a collapse of a back leg as well, then you're going to find yourself that your front leg will buckle as a result. It can also be that your body weight is too far back at point of release and at point of contact with your front foot. So those are the main things from a technical. So work your way back. It's often alignment. And without seeing your bowl, obviously I can't confirm that, but it's the alignment of the back foot to the front foot. If they're in line and everything is being directed towards your target area, then it gives you a best possible chance. The final thing to look at is how your foot lands. And this goes back to the TRAM principle of increasing time, range, area and mass. By getting your heel contact and then going over the full range of the foot plate, and that will absorb the ground forces better. If you go with a toe land, then you're going to have more acute ground forces going down into the ground and then coming back up the kinetic chain, and the first thing that goes is the knee bend. So I'm sure in Ponte's book, having read it, if I recall back, then a heel strike is preferable because you get that full range of movement abiding by that TRAM principle that I've written about and talk about now. So have a look at alignment, have a look at how your heel lands on the front foot and work at that within the drills, within the four tent peg drills that he talks about, and you won't go too far wrong.
Of course, Laver's a braced front leg is an indicator of pace, but it's only one of them. So if he does struggle with this kind of a problem and he can't get past that issue of a bent front leg, he could still bowl fast, couldn't he?
Absolutely. I think having a straight front leg on impact is one of the key indicating factors of a fast bowler, and that's something that a lot of coaches will look out for these days. However, it's not the be-all and end-all. It doesn't mean that you can't bowl fast. Similarly to, you still see some people who will bowl off the wrong foot, as it were, and still bowl quickly. So other people will bowl 90 miles an hour, and one of the other key factors is running in quick. And some people, trying to think of a few now, but someone like Craig White, who pushed past 90 miles an hour at times, he just jogged in, and there are other guys around in the past who have done that. So just because you miss one of the boxes doesn't mean you can tick the other four or five that there are and still get some decent pace up. obviously it sounds like something he's specifically targeted, and it may be that he's ticking the other boxes and he feels very, very confident with the rest of his technique. And if he wants to then zone in on that that area to improve on, then that's great, because he's presumably bowling pretty well already. But if he does want to sort of try and develop that front leg, I actually had a checklist of a few things I wanted to talk about, and over the last sort of 2.5 minutes of Gareth talking, they've all gone off my list. So in terms of drills, though, I think, as with anything, it's taking things back to basics, getting back to a standing start, and having a look at if he's able to maintain a straight front leg from a standing start. And you often find that people can do, because they're able to maintain their alignment, they're able to keep their body weight forwards, they're not having an excessive jump, and it's a lot easier to control that heel strike first. So it's often identifying at what stage we go from being able to execute technique as we'd like it, whether it's altering our arms or altering our feet, or in this case bracing our front leg, and what case that starts to fade away. And often that's when the jump gets introduced, or when a reasonable pace comes into the pre-jump, is when we start to lose control. But it'd be good for him to go back to basics, get standing still, line up his feet as Gareth suggested, try and get that heel strike in first, and then start to reverse chain it back towards that full run-up, and work out at which stage or which phase of that development he starts to lose that bracing of the front leg again. Then he can identify where he needs to focus his attention while he's away from the nets.
You mentioned their reverse chaining, or you know, going through the movement backwards, if you like, to get to the point where you can correct anything that's going wrong there. That's a brilliant way of doing it. Have you ever come across, Gareth, someone who can do it at one stage, you know, a walk through or maybe a jog through, but when they bring in another factor, they can't do it no matter how much they try? And what do you do at that point?
Well, the key thing is momentum, isn't it? So if we think about the reverse chaining principle, and this is where that four temp pegs drill, which I know that Ponty works with a lot, Steph works with a lot, and I work with a fair bit as well, is really good. If as soon as you introduce momentum, at some point, if there is a technical problem, it will reveal itself when that is. So, you know, as Sam talked about, you do your statics and you do your one steps and you do your four steps and you work your way back until you come off your full run. Now, if you can get through that full range holding everything together, then, you know, whoop-de-doo, you're going great guns, and off you go. But at some point, momentum will impact negatively on that with most players that you come across. And all I ever do is I go back to the previous place, really nail that down, and then test it with more momentum a little bit later, and then I'll go back and then come forward, and over time you'll find that your momentum increases until eventually you get to your full run-up pace and you're in your full action. So that's my process with it, and I think it's a brilliant way of working. And it's a bit like, you know, if you want to compare it with batting, one of the things that I got taught very young is that we do our drills, and then once we've to develop a technique that we're trying to work on, then when we've got those drills nailed, then we go and put it into a net situation to test its effectiveness in a match situation. And then we get that right, and if it breaks down a little bit, we revert back to the drill, and then we come back into that match practice. And eventually, once we've got that match practice right, then we take that off and show it off in a game. And it's exactly the same principle when we're dealing with reverse chaining in fast bowlers.
So what you're saying is that it will always work eventually. It just depends on how quickly that particular bowler can get it. And you just need to flip-flop back and forth until it gets to the point where it's locked in.
Pretty much. And these guys that I work with out in Switzerland, they talk about whether somebody is ready or not ready. And that might be physically ready or not ready. It might be their attention. They might be ready one day or not ready the next. Or eventually they're not ready for a long time, and eventually they are ready and it just clicks into place. And this is why patience is such a crucial characteristic of good coaches, is that sometimes it doesn't work in a linear fashion and we just have to be patient. You know, somebody's physicality might not be quite up to the task, and even if they've got the capacity to do the technique at a low intensity, they might not be able to hold that when they come off a full run. We'll be patient, because at some stage, if they're doing the right strength and conditioning and maintain some good drills where they can hold it all together, it will happen. But we have to be patient, and players will get there. You look at a Mitchell Johnson from a bowling point of view, you know, he's now ready. And probably not a lot's changed, and we've discussed this a lot, but probably not a lot's changed. He's ready because the environment's right, he feels loved, and all of those different things. He's been working hard ever since I first met him, which was a number of years ago now, so nothing's changed in that respect. He's just ready to do what he's doing, in the same way as Brendan McCullum is ready as a test batter now to make some really big things happen. But you've got to be patient with these guys. You know, we're human, and patience is a crucial aspect of teaching or coaching.
There you go, Rush, be patient, put the work in, keep going, and you'll get there in the end if you keep on trying. Okay, let's head over to the newsroom now. Daisy Cutter is waiting with this week's Pitch Vision headlines.
Thank you, guys. Hi, I'm Daisy Cutter, and this is the Pitch Vision News. Cricket South Africa is putting the final touches to the High Performance Centre in Pretoria. Pitch Vision team are hard at work fitting and calibrating the unique batting shot tracking alongside the already up and running bowler tracking this week. The centre opens on the 10th of March with Dale Steyn to bowl the first official ball at the venue. In England, new additions to the Pitch Vision family, the Oxfordshire Academy, have been pre-season training on the system. Spinners have been looking at how their pace influenced the turn they get, while batters use PV video to improve footwork. Coach Daryl Woods commented, "Having this technology helps emphasise the points when chatting to young players." Pitch Vision's interactive world leagues are on for another year. Countries are rated by various elements tracked on Pitch Vision to decide on who's the best. The early frontrunner is England, with leads in the runs scored and wickets taken. Meanwhile, their old enemy Australia have their nose in front on the bowling pace. Visit pitchvision.com/interactive to find out where your country ranks. For more details on these stories, check out the show notes at pitchvision.com. That's the Pitch Vision news for this week. I've been Daisy Cutter, and now it's back to the panel.
It's time for this week's 60-second burst on the soapbox, and coming up this week is Lavers. He's going to be talking about something to do with cricket, and he's going to keep doing it for 60 seconds. Lavers, your time starts now.
Okay, well, my topic for the day is more about looking after the ball and how we do it, and that it seems to be coming up a little bit in conversation at the moment on TV, on Sky Sports, that the way the ball's being treated maybe isn't quite fair, and it's introducing reverse swing in an unnatural way. I've seen a lot of people talk about it. I've heard a lot of conversations that have suggested that people throwing the ball into the floor is unfair and shouldn't be something that the fielders are allowed to do, shouldn't be something that the keeper's allowed to do, because that's unfairly creating a rough side of the ball or impacting on the ball and creating swing, which we shouldn't be allowed to do, and it's possibly ball tampering. At the moment, as far as I'm aware, it's something that is we're allowed to throw the ball in and bounce it once. Bob Willis and Dominic Cork both suggested that it's something we should be allowed to do. So maybe at the moment the laws as they are should allow us to do it, but it's something that should be reviewed again in the future.
Right then, that is all we've got time for on this week's show. We're going to wrap it up any moment now, but before we go, we've just got to decide on the competition winner for this week. And we had a couple of questions. We had Shiv's question about bat weight, and we had Rush's question, not Ian, just Rush's question, about fast bowling and the braced front leg. So the winner wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. Gareth, which one did you prefer? It's the moment of truth.
I'm going to go for Rush the Fast Bowler, because I think it's a great name for a fast bowler. And also it's brilliant that he's already invested some time in developing his skills by looking at the ultimate pace secrets on Pitch Vision. And I'm going to reward him for all of that and a great question by having the opportunity to buy another course and to continue to develop himself.
Well then, Rush, nobody ever got more stupid by reading a book. So well done for taking the first step. And the second step is another online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So there's plenty of fast bowling ones to choose from there. Now, Gareth, if somebody wanted to get in touch with the show, send in their question and have their chance of winning the prize, what would they need to do?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right. At Pitch Vision Acad is our Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook if you go to facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. Lots of fun going on there, plenty of chatter about all kinds of cricket coaching and playing topics. You can also subscribe to this show. Every week we produce it, so why not listen every week? You can do that in iTunes if you just do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, or you can go to pitchvision.com/academy, click on the podcast link, and you'll find the RSS feed for adding to any podcatching program that you like. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, boys.
Thanks, guys.